throughout the Bible, especially the Old Testament, there are these little hidden things. Maybe not hidden, they're just right there in plain sight, but it seems like sometimes you read across something and you're like, oh, I really never noticed that before. And, you know, Bruce Wilkinson made a lot of money off of one of those with the prayer of Jabez. These days I'll figure out how to do that. But anyway, there's something that's real interesting to me in Genesis 36. So if you want to turn there real quick, I just want to mention this, and then I may need a volunteer or two tonight. In Genesis chapter 36 is all about the descendants of Esau and the Edomites, and it tells about his descendants and the little it calls them dukes, the little chieftains, the scattered tribes of the Edomites. And as it goes down, it says, verse 24, and these are the children of Zibeon, both Ajah and Anah. And then it says it in a way that the people of Moses' day should have known what he was talking about, and maybe even later than that. This was that Anah that found the mules in the wilderness as he fed the asses of Zibeon his father. And I find that to be fascinating. For several reasons. First of all, like I say, the way he says it, people should have known who that was. In antiquity, there is, according to Herodotus and other historians, a fellow who is credited with the first use of mules. Now, a mule is a really interesting creature. One of the reasons he's really interesting is if you don't have a King James Version of the Bible, that says he found some hot springs. And that just bugs me, because a mule doesn't look like a hot spring. It's not even close to being a hot spring. So what is it? Did he find hot springs while he was tending to his father's asses, or did he find mules? And it just really bothers me. One of the things that scholars say is that the other uses of the word mule in the New Testament is not that Hebrew word. It's a different Hebrew word. And we talked a little bit about the use of the word donkey. You'll never find that in the Bible either. So over time, we sometimes change the names of things, don't we? Depending on, you know, 200 years ago, you would have called it an ass. Today, call it a donkey, probably because of the improper connotations of the word ass and what that has become to be known, and so we don't want to say it a wordy dirt, right? But over time, words change, probably. Here's what I think about this verse. I think this fellow found the first mules. Now, God didn't make a mule. A mule is a very, 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 very interesting creature. He is totally different than a horse, and he's totally different than an ass. So what is he? How do you get a mule? Not my family, because you already had this. How do you get a mule?
Donkey and horse.
Which one's which?
Horses and mare.
Okay, a mare and a jack ass will give you donkey. What if you have a stud horse and a female donkey? It will. It's called a hinny. And a hinny is not a mule. And a mule is not a hinny.
She's sterile, isn't she?
So is a mule, for the most part. Probably 95% of mules are sterile. Because, why are they sterile? Because they're different kinds. And God says everything will bring forth after its kind. But there are a few animals, like Napoleon Dynamite's favorite animal, the liker, that you can get one generation out of, but then they'll be sterile. And that's a mule. Now, somebody tell me the difference between a horse and a mule. What's one difference between a horse and a mule? Not my family. We already did this.
Hollow
head?
No, I'm trying to think.
The bone structure of their head certainly is different. I don't know whether it's hollow or not.
They're usually called
mules or horses?
Mules.
Their ears.
They got bigger ears,
yeah,
for sure.
They're high.
They definitely have a different disposition.
The workability.
Wait, what is it?
A mule is, and I would argue with that, but yes.
Oh. I'm sorry, I didn't grow up on a farm.
No, but this is why I wanted to talk about this. Most people, if you haven't been around them, so they got bigger ears, and Kim says their workability. Mules were bred throughout time because they are bigger than an ass, but they have more endurance than a horse, for the most part. That's not always the truth. For anything. What's another difference between a mule and a horse? Their feet. A mule has different feet than a horse. A horse's feet look like... A horse's feet look like this. A mule's feet look like this. They're straight at the heels, where a horse's heels turn in just a little bit, very round. If you see shod or unshod tracks, you can tell a mule from a horse instantly. Anybody could. There's a town in Texas just outside of Clovis called Mule Shoe. That's what a mule shoe looks like. It doesn't look like a horseshoe. What else? What's another difference between a mule and a horse? Their tails, that's right. Their tails are different. A horse has hair that starts at his tail head and comes down like this, all the way down. And a mule has got a tail that starts out like almost like a cow's tail and then begins to have hair that comes down. And it's really very obvious once you take a look at it. What's another difference between a horse and a mule?
Withers.
That's right. Mules do not have withers. So what's withers?
Shoulders.
Yeah, just behind where the neck meets the backbone. So withers on a horse's neck comes down, and then he's got a little bit more, that's a really bad drawing, but he's got a little bit more prominent withers, and especially this way. So when you saddle a horse, when you measure a horse, that's where you measure to. The height to his withers is how you measure how tall. What do you measure a horse in?
Hands.
Right. Well, that's how many hands from the ground to his withers. But a mule doesn't have withers, so how do you saddle a mule? That's right, with a britchet. A mule comes down, and he is mutton withered. So if you put your saddle on a mule, pretty soon you'll be up right up over his neck because he doesn't have anything. He's very wide and very muscular right through the top of his shoulders right here. And it's just like saddling a sheep. They're called mutton withered. And so you use a britchet, which either hangs down, you tie on, so if you got your saddle on here, like this, it either has a strap that ties to the back of the saddle and comes underneath his tail, right there, just like that, and back up, to keep your saddle from pulling forward, or a harness, or you use a britchet that ties on to the back of the saddle and hangs down and comes down right underneath his hind end, right there, and hangs down like that to keep that saddle or that harness from scooting forward. And so very, very different animal, okay? Now, what's the difference between a Comanche and an Apache?
Helicopter.
Is there a Comanche helicopter? There is an Apache helicopter for sure. Let's go back a couple of hundred years. That's right. Apaches love mules. It was their favorite food. They wouldn't hardly eat an old sheep. Oh, they didn't want a sheep at all. But they loved mules. Horses, they were okay. Now, Comanches loved horses. Apaches loved mules. But Comanches loved to ride horses. Yeah. Apaches loved to eat mules. So, who's the largest producer in the last 200 years and user of mules? That's right, the United States military, the Army. Do you know how many mules they would have had right here at Fort Concho and Fort Chadburn and all the mules, mules, mules? Why? Beasts of burden. The Army specifically, they had people all up, especially in Missouri, but all up and down the working their way toward the frontier, that specifically bred mules to to sell to the army. And they would bring them out here onto the plains, and the Apaches would just like the coyote looking at the roadrunner, they just, an Apache would ride a horse to death and then eat the horse. And then he'd keep going. The Comanches would ride a horse, and then they would rest him. And then they'd steal all of your horses so they could make sure they kept them alive. But the Apaches loved mule meat. And I get all of that, right there. No, but here's what's so interesting to me. I think what God is doing here in his word is I think he's telling us, hey, I didn't make that mule, but neither did man, because these first mules right here were wild. This was not a domesticated situation, but this is the guy that found them. So he's following his father, had large herds of asses, and he's pasturing them and grazing them in the wilderness, and he's following them out through the wilderness. And what do you know? Somehow they ran across some herds of horses, and he witnessed the interbreeding of these jacks and those mares, and he saw these mules. And when he did, he said, hey, there is something that could be very beneficial as a to put on a borax box, right? Right? So, all right. So enough of that. Let's go to Matthew. Who's got a, who likes to eat rocks? Anybody here?
Yes, salt.
You want to eat some rocks?
Salt.
Cash eats rocks? You want to eat a rock? Put your hand up. You want to eat a rock?
Is it rock candy?
Somebody want to eat her? You better. Give us one. Do you know that salt? Eat it, Natalie. You want to eat a rock? You want to eat a rock? Oh, come on. You eat a rock? Put your hand out.
Just
eat that rock. You want to eat one? Quiet, you want to eat a rock? We eat a rock?
You
want to
eat a rock?
You eat a rock? Here, get your rock. Is it good? Cole?
Theo's like, I'm not so sure.
Did you know that that is the only rock that human beings can eat? Well, I mean,
he goes.
And you know, and it actually be good for you?
No.
Matthew. In Matthew, Jesus. Now, don't get a drink, because we're gonna prove a point here in a minute. Matthew chapter 5. Jesus says, "Ye are the what? Salt of the earth." Ye are the salt of the earth. What is that? That kind of statement.
Metaphor.
That is a metaphor. A teacher answered that question and not a student. Why is it not a simile? Why is it not hyperbole?
It's not exaggerated.
He wasn't exaggerating, was he? David's going, I don't know about that. See, that's why English is so ridiculous, because there's many answers to that.
I thought someone said at church that if you don't listen to your English teacher, you'll go
wrong. Well, you should. Because it also is hyperbole. It is a comparison. It is a metaphor, but it's also hyperbole. Is anybody here actually salt? We are the salt of the earth. What do you salt for? Seasoned food.
Preserve
what?
Meat.
Hide.
But you know what? Has anybody here actually used salt to preserve something? What'd you use it for?
Pumpkin skin.
Okay.
We got to do it in some fish.
Okay. So salt some fish. Did you know that the British, all the European militaries, the very first thing when they got ready to invade somebody, the very first thing they did, especially once they figured out that there were codfish in the Atlantic, the first thing they did was put in an order for millions of pounds of salted cod. Because you got to feed an army. If you run out of food, then you're in trouble. Millions and millions of pounds of salted cod was the very first thing that they did. So how do you get salt? Where does it come from? Naturally occurring all over the earth as well as the sea. There's really two ways that they got it throughout history, two ways that we get it now today. One is evaporation pools. So you just trap ocean water and let the sun evaporate it, and then you just go scrape it up, right? And the other one is through mining. But here's the thing. Salt, there's probably been more wars fought over salt than there have over oil. At this point in time, it was one of the most important commodities. If you, let me think. In England, if the town ends in the word witch, so like sandwich, that type town, that is a salt mine town or a salt producing town. The Romans actually built a road called the Via Salaria, which was the salt road. When Marco Polo made his journey from Genoa to the Khans in way far East Asia, his purpose was to try to figure out how to trade spices, but a massive part of that had to do with salt. And not only that, but he went over there and fraternized with a bunch of communists and then brought the idea back to Genoa, and they never did adopt it. But the Chinese controlled their salt trade completely. Whoever the emperor was, they controlled it. The Genoans, they taxed the snot out of it. So did the French. So on the salt roads, what they would do is they would set up every town. As you brought salt through the town, well, you'd have to pay a tax. Pay a tax to go through their town, pay a tax to land in their ports. And so it was a huge, 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 it was the oil of their day. Now, why is it not like that today? Salt is cheap. You get salt anywhere. Why is it not like that today? Because we got electricity. We can get ice. We've got refrigerators. We've got freezers. But before that, what are you going to do with food? Did you know those ancient ships, when they went to sea to go fish, they went, and if they actually found fish and they caught them, they had to immediately return home as fast as they could and try to get those fish traded off. Why? Because they'll spoil. And certain fish, like halibut, are very fatty, and they only got about 24 hours until they start spoiling. It's one of the reasons why they love codfish, because there's not very much fat in them. So it's fascinating to me. I did just a little bit of reading about this and thinking about it, because, you know, if Jesus were to say this today, he might use something different. When he said this, for you and I, we're like, oh, yeah, he's seasoned food with it, you know. But in his day, you're talking about one of the most important commodities that they had. To preserve food, if this changed, the idea of preserving food with salt eliminated dependence on seasonal availability. I want you to just think about living in Texas. Now, if you lived in Iowa or somewhere like that, this time of year, you could go out and butcher a hog or kill a deer or butcher a beef or a goat, and you could get it in a shady place where there was a little bit of breeze, and you could hang up the carcass and leave it there, and every night, what would it do?
Freeze,
and then it might thaw during the day, it might not, it might stay frozen. That thing would last for weeks and months. What about Texas? The stankin' rank would within just a few days, especially in January when you have 70 and 80 degree days in January, right? So apart from salt, and refrigeration, you are absolutely tied to using something like a meat or even a vegetable immediately. Did you know that salt preservation of food, I mean, it's funny to listen to what historians say, because they're looking at, you know, their ideas of history. But I'm thinking Adam understood how to use salt to do these kinds of things. But basically, as far back as history goes, the use of salt, for vegetables, the use of these kinds of things would have been all the way back since time. What I'm saying is pagan philosophers say, you know, that it started at a particular point in time, but the use of this has been going on forever. Speaking of, what I mean, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people at Christmas time, what do they do? What do they eat? If you're British, what do you eat for Christmas? A corned beef, some kind of corned beef, old corned beef. Irish, if you're Irish, no British or Irish people. What is corned beef? Never had it?
He said, what is corned beef? He said, gross.
It's a salt-cured brined beef. They make a brine and they cure it that way. Hams. The use of salt-cured hams goes back all the way to the ancient Celts, that they would do this. The Romans stole it from them when they invaded them. So when there's certain areas of the country today, prosciutto. Anybody know what prosciutto is? I don't either, but that's the Italian bacon or something like that. But it's a specific area and a specific way of curing pork. They've been doing it for thousands of years. The term salary comes from the word for salt, and at certain points in time, not only the Romans but other militaries actually paid their soldiers at least partially in salt. Caravans with as many as 40,000 camels traveled across the Sahara for 400 or 500 miles to Timbuktu, carrying salt, transporting salt across the desert to trade, as well as slaves. Cities along salt roads taxed. British intercepted revolutionary salt shipments during the Revolutionary War to shut down the colonists' ability to preserve food. Lewis and Clark expedition was partially launched by the justification of Thomas Jefferson saying that there were rumors of a salt mountain 180 miles long and 45 miles wide along the Missouri River, which they didn't find. But in a little farther south than that, they actually found probably what the rumors came from, a massive salt flat there up against a mountain that had a seep underneath it that kept the brining process going on. So when we think about it, and I just wanted to kick that around just a little bit just to get you to think, why would Jesus use this term? Because salt is absolutely essential to life. You have to have it. We live in a day and time where salt is now bad. But if you actually look at and watch any cooking show, just pick your cooking show. I don't care which one it is. Just pick it. Gordon Ramsay, don't watch him. He has a filthy mouth and he makes me mad every time he opens it. But he's apparently a pretty good British cook. Any cooking show. Well, it's the thing that they use in every single dish that they cook.
Salt.
Every single one of them. Every single time. Why? Because you have to have it to live. If you don't have it, you'll die. And ancient sailors wound up, you know, we talk about scurvy, but they could also get to a place where they were lacking in salt, which seems really stupid because all they had to do was lick the deck. But it had to do with what they were doing with their diet. So Jesus says this, you are the salt of the earth. Now, did you know what he says in of himself? Does he call himself the salt of the earth? No, he calls us. He calls his followers the salt of the earth. So if salt preserves and salt seasons, then that's what we're like. To take something and to preserve it. Christians in the world have a preserving effect in the world around them. So I like to think of the world as a piece of meat. And God has Christians scattered throughout that piece of meat for two reasons. If we weren't here, what would happen? The natural process, what would happen? It'll start to, it'll get rank, it'll rot, right? It'll get nasty and it'll rot. And that's exactly what would happen if God wasn't at work in the world. But he says that we're the salt. We have this purpose. How do you make cheese? What's cheese made out of? Milk and if it's fresh cheese, like ricotta, well that's yeah, some cheeses. But if it's fresh cheese like ricotta, it doesn't have much salt in it. But if it's any kind of aged cheese at all, they gotta let it sit to let the process take place, right? They said that you know, I don't know, has anybody ever seen those giant wheels of cheese that they make over there in Europe, like this big round? They said it takes an entire year. Once they put it in the mold and form it, they pack it in salt, and it takes an entire year for that piece of cheese, which is nothing more than just curdled milk, to work from the outside to get all the way to the middle. And that's the art form of making cheese, is to make sure that they're either carving off of the outside or waiting until the very center. Once it hits the very center, boom, that's when it's ready and it needs to be used. It's aged the perfect amount of time at that point in time. The use of this preserving thing is timeless. For you and I, we eat a spiral cut ham at Christmas or New Year's or something like that, but we have to go buy it. We have to import these things. But for their world, the world that they lived in, it was absolutely essential. So, he says, you're the salt. But, look what he says. He gives us a warning here. But if the salt have lost his savor, wherewith shall it be salted? Now that has just caused Bible commentators all kinds of problems. How does salt lose its savor? Can salt lose its savor? What is salt, by the way?
It's a mineral.
It is a mineral. And you know what's cool about salt is you can dissolve it in water and then evaporate the water, and what do you got? So about salt, right? So is there any way that sodium chloride can stop being sodium chloride? Nope.
If you mix it with another substance.
It's still salt.
It's still sodium chloride, but you don't have the concentration there.
Well, maybe not, but it's still salt. And all you have to do is separate it. Some people say that ancient forms of salt were so diluted with other things that, you know, this, that, and the other. I think that's to totally miss the point. Can salt lose its savor? No, not salt. Salt is salt. And whether it's dissolved in water, like in the ocean, or whether it's in crystal form, like what we saw tonight, it's still salt. And you're a Christian. And you have a job to do. Now, it would make no sense whatsoever for a Christian to stop being salty. But do we do that? Sometimes we do. Sometimes our flavoring of the world around us is not happening. And sometimes our preserving of the world around us is not happening. And I think that's why I think he's using this as an exaggeration. He's using this, and here's why I think that. Because he says in the very next thing, he says, by the way, it's worthless. It's good for nothing to be cast out and trodden underfoot of men. Anybody ever been to one of those big downtown cities where they throw the trash out the window? Like New York, some great place like that. That's what they did. They threw their trash out the front door. That's what I do too. When I don't ever pour grease down the drain, I just step to the front door and just throw it out, right? That's what he's saying. That's what you would do. If you got some salt and it didn't make you thirsty and it didn't tingle your tongue and it didn't taste like salt, you'd throw it out. So what good is a Christian who won't act like a Christian? Worthless. That's what he's saying. Don't be worthless. Turn over, if you will, real quick to Mark chapter 9, verse 15. Mark chapter 9, verse 15. Jesus says, salt is good. And you should underline that. The next time you go see your doctor, you show that to them. The Bible says salt is good. By the way, salt is good. You have to have it to live. But if the salt have lost its saltiness, wherewith will you season it? Can you see that what Jesus is doing here? He's saying, look, if salt doesn't do its job, if it doesn't preserve, and if it doesn't flavor, then why would you eat a rock? Anybody ever ate sand? Get some grit in your food? Man, it's terrible, isn't it? Would you intentionally do that? No, it'll wear your teeth off or nothing. It's worthless. So then look what he says. Have salt in yourselves and have peace one with another. You know what you call an old sailor that knows their way around the deck of a ship and is pretty handy? Good to have around?
He's worth his salt.
He's salty. He's worth his salt. You find all of these idioms in our language because salt is so absolutely essential to life, and for years and years and years and years and years, wars were fought over salt. Businesses rose and fell over salt. Christopher Columbus broke the Genoan salt business by going the other way. Did you know that? Busted them wide open because they had a monopoly on the salt business. The French had a tax that was dreaded. It was worse than... it's worse than Texas property taxes. And they had some fancy French word for it. And it was salt tax. So Jesus says, have salt in yourself. Be salty. Let's look at Colossians real quick. Chapter 4. Colossians 4, verse 6. Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt. You know, on all those cooking shows, sometimes my kids like to watch those cooking shows, and they're kind of interesting sometimes. Of course, most of the time they cook something ridiculous that nobody would actually ever eat. But you know how to lose? Don't put salt in the dish. Serve those snooty food critics something that hasn't been salted, and you'll lose. They'll throw you out. That'll be the end of it. Did you salt this? Did you taste this before you served this? Look what he says. He says, let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt. A good cook always licks the spoon. Always. You wouldn't set something before somebody without tasting it. And if it needs salt, you add salt, right? A good cook...
get another spoon.
The stern spoon. He says, let your speech always be seasoned with salt. Is your speech always seasoned with salt? What does that mean? Well, when you talk to somebody, what he's saying is you should have the flavor of Christ in you. Be salty. Be valuable to the kingdom of God, no matter what is going on. That you may know how you ought to answer every man. Be salty. You know, this really is what is missing in our world, I think. So many times, is salty Christians. People who realize that we are ambassadors for Christ everywhere that we go. Our speech seasoned with salt, to have salt in ourselves, to realize that we are flavoring and we are preserving the rotting corpse of this world that's all around us. And how essential it is to the life of the world around us. Not only that, but here's why I think he's not talking about it. I think he's using it as an exaggeration. Verse 14, he says, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid. And boy, it's so true. San Angelo does not sit on a hill. But if you will go south of town out there to that hill, you can see the lights of San Angelo for about 20, 25 miles. And if you could get higher, you could see it for farther than that. And if you've ever traveled to a city that actually does sit on a hill, once it gets dark, you can see it forever. You can't hide it. There's no way. Do you know, my granddad, when he was in the military, he said that he knew of it happening in his days, and he was in the military in the 40s, to fall asleep on guard duty or to mess up on guard duty was punishable by death in the military at that point in time. And he said, I never saw anybody put to death for it, but I did see people court-martialed because of not paying attention on guard duty. But he said one of the absolute big-time no-nos on guard duty was to smoke. And everybody smoked in 1940-something. Everybody smoked. You know why? Because you can see a cherry from a cigarette for miles and miles and miles. Miles away. And so he says, look, he says, you're the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Neither do men light a candle and put it under a bushel. So you wouldn't do that, but you should try it sometime. I was going to try this tonight, but I've decided to be deep rocks instead. So you take and light a candle or turn on a flashlight and then put a bucket over it. What's it do? Puts the light out, right? You can't see it. Does anybody do that? Does anybody light a candle and then put something, keep the candle burning, but put something over it to shroud the light? Would anybody ever, no, no one would ever do that. You wouldn't do that. Just put the candle out if you want it dark. That's why I think he's not telling us about impure salt or something like that. What he's saying is it doesn't make sense for salt not to be salty. It doesn't make sense for a candle not to give light. And it doesn't make sense for Christians to not act like Christians. It's important. We preserve, we flavor, and we bring light. Now, this one is amazing because Jesus did say in John chapter 8 and verse 12, he said, I am the light of the world. Here he very clearly says, you are the light of the world. So, if the light of the world lives in us, then his light's going to shine through us. And that's what should be happening in our lives. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 5 real quick. Ephesians chapter 5 verse 8. He says, for ye were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the Lord. What a great verse. It's a great verse. You know, like Wendy said, Billy, like so many of us, he's got an old life, an old past, a life lived before he knew Jesus, and that life is darkness. This is what he says to these Ephesian Christians. You used to walk in the dark. In time past, that's what you were, but now you are the light. He doesn't say, look how he says it. He says, you were sometimes darkness. You were the darkness. Now you are the light. So, walk as children of light. He breaks that into two parts. And I think that's where I want to close tonight, and I think that's the most important thing about this. The first part is the positional part. Okay? You are the light. The second part is the conditional part. Walk as children of light. You've got to know who you are so that you can live in such a way that you reflect your true identity in Christ. So many times we go back to that old identity. We go back to those old haunts. You know, the recidivism rate of a person spending time in prison is about 80%. That means that if somebody goes to prison, they do their time and they get out, 80% of them are going to be back in prison. It's something that some people have decided that we should throw prison, the idea of prison out altogether because it just doesn't work. But I've got a judge friend in Clovis, and he said, anytime I have a hearing for somebody who's getting paroled or something like that, or has done their time and they don't have to see him, but they're getting short time for some reason, he says, I always tell them the same thing. You know, you need to think about what got you in here. You need to think of, you know, was it drugs and alcohol? Was it stealing? Was it whatever it was? You need to think about what wound you up in prison. And you need to think about the people that you used to hang out with. before you wound up in prison. And then you need to stay away from those things, those places, and those people. And then he said, I tell them this. It's really, really hard to wind up in prison by spending your time in Bible studies and church fellowships. He said, if you want to see your life change, you need to change the people you spend, the people that you used to hang out with that got you here. You need to change those things. So you know, that is just strictly, and he is a believer, but that's strictly from a moralistic standpoint. What Jesus is telling us is he's saying, look, this is who you are. You're salt. Salt does something. Anybody ever salted something too much?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Salt has an effect, doesn't it? A little bit of salt, a little bit of effect, a little bit more salt, a little bit more effect. Too much salt, ruined it, right? So can salt lose its savor? No, not real salt. It's impossible. So as a Christian, walk as the salty person that you are. That's what he says in Mark 9. Be salt. Have salt in yourself. Be salty dogs when it comes to the Christian life. Now, it wasn't too long ago somebody was telling me they were making excuses what they were doing. Well, I just haven't read all my Bible. I haven't done this. I haven't done that. I haven't been a Christian for a long time. Well, fix it. Change it. Who's read Treasure Island or Tale of Two Cities? Anybody read Treasure Island? How long did it take Jim Hawkins to figure out his way around the ship? Does it take him a long time? Do you think they would have put up with a whole bunch of excuses? No, they throw you overboard. You do your job. I don't know how to swap the deck. Well, I bet you figure it out, don't you? Right? And so how do you get to be a salty old sailor? If you learn your job, if you learn the next job, and you learn everything there is to learn around the deck of a ship, and you when you show up, you do your part. And how do you learn to be a salty Christian? You spend time with Jesus, and you put it into practice. And I think that's what he's telling us. If our righteousness is going to exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, we're going to have to live out of who we are. We're salt and we're light. Amen? Father, we love you. We thank you for this.